For those of you who listened recently to my episode with the Scuttlebutt crew, here is a similar type of episode. We do touch on book marketing, which I think is always an important piece of TRBM, but this episode goes pretty broad and pretty wide into maybe the lifestyle habits of artists and the types of things that we do to produce creativity. I know for myself, I talk a lot about the pitfalls of some of the fascinations on the periphery of my life, such as drugs, alcohol, and the like. If you're not comfortable with conversations that perhaps don't dismiss drugs as all bad, you might want to skip this episode, and I'd be totally fine with that. But I don't think that you should skip it, because I think that my guest and often co-host Christopher Talon has some pretty fantastic stuff to say about the creative life, marketing, and his experience getting out on the road and selling books in person. Yep, he's another one. In fact, he was doing it before I was doing it, and I was paying attention to some of the successes he was having. So in a way, he served as part of the inspiration for me to start doing out there shows, and I'm thankful for that. Also, if you listen to my episode on Monday, you know that just after this conversation concluded, Christopher was the one who kind of helped open up for me some issues I was having processing through grief. So lots of wisdom here, maybe in an unconditional setting. And so I encourage you to listen with your thinking caps on and really dig, because there's a lot of treasure to be had here. Without further ado, please enjoy my guest and sometimes co-host, Christopher Talon.
This is TRBM Ammo Edition. If you're a published author and want to make a living writing books and selling them to avid readers, you've come to the right place. There's simply no program that's more successful at driving readers towards the books you've written. So the only thing you have to worry about is writing a great book. And the system with an ammo takes care of the rest. Thanks for listening to this conversation.
You all right over there?
Yeah, that's going to be a consistent thing for me throughout this talk. I still...
You sound better, though. You sound like you've...
I've got my voice mostly
de-aged back. Like another 25, 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. When I was a cigarette smoker, I used to lose my voice completely, like clockwork, every winter for about 3 days. I would wake up not feeling sick in the least. Nothing was wrong with me, but my voice just disappeared. And it would be like that for 3 days. If you talk to my old, the guys that I managed at Pugs, like they would be like, yeah, there would be just a day where he did the cadence call and he didn't have any voice. It was so strange. So that's the first time since being a smoker that I've lost my voice. But this is COVID kicked my ass and is still actually kind of kicking my ass. It's been a long 7 days now.
And how many times have you had it?
This would be the second confirmed case. Both times that I confirmed, I actually confirmed when I lost my sense of smell and taste. So
when the smell goes, that's the first thing everyone's like, uh-oh.
What? Yeah, exactly. It still is. Even the second time around, you're just like, this is so strange. And ironically, both times I discovered it when I cracked beer. So I'd been carnivore. I'm going back to carnivore. Actually, I decided I like myself better on carnivore, but, I cracked a Miller Lite on December 22nd, 2021, and I took a sip of it, and I was sitting in my reading chair at night, and I was like, it tastes disgusting, which ultimately it was just that it didn't have any taste at all, so it was carbonated nothing, yeah. And that to me was like, there's something wrong with this. So like, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm telling Ash, and I'd been sick, and she's like, you should go like smell the cinnamon. So I go, I get the cinnamon from the pantry, I open it up, stick my nose in, nothing. Like, and I was like, oh shoot.
Yeah.
And then same thing this time. I cracked a PBR. I had a PBR. I cracked it open, tasted it, and I was like, oh, disgusting. And then it was like immediately I knew as soon as that happened, I was like, oh, I've got COVID.
So yeah. The first time, well, actually I've only had it once that I know of and confirm for sure.
Yeah.
But it was because I give blood pretty regularly to the, you know, this.
That's right.
I have it on there. But yeah. I just got my 3-gallon pin from the Red Cross. But they used to tell you during COVID and, you know, kind of after the big wave of it, they would test your blood and let you know if you would have, you know, traces of it still. And so I took a blood test like last year or the year before in April. Yeah, it might've been 2 years ago. And they're like, oh, it looks like you already had COVID once, huh? I was like, oh, I did? And I didn't even know it.
Yeah. Yeah. I sent out my, I sent out a weekly newsletter type thing to any of my book buyers who go on my subscriber list. And I hypothesized that COVID will actually be the thing that kills me, because for whatever reason, when I get it really bad. My wife has had it multiple times and like barely stops her. I actually am suspicious she got it from me this time around. She said yesterday her head felt really heavy. And then today I was like, how are you feeling? She's like, perfect. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird thing, man, because some people that like looking back, I can remember one day where I just had like the worst headache ever and felt like crap and kind of slept through the day. Mm-hmm. But it was like one day of that. And then the next day I was like, oh, well, like maybe it was something I ate. Maybe I just didn't get enough sleep. I don't know.
What is author marketing mastery through optimization, you ask? I'm going to tell you. It's the best way for us authors to make a living selling our books. Are you tired of hearing gurus tell you your book is only good enough to be a lead magnet for services? Are you tired of feeling like you have to be a slave to social media and then frustrated when the time you spend doesn't actually help you sell books? I was too, until I found Ammo. Ammo is the only program that reliably produces results, and it works for anyone. Is it hard work? You bet. Do you have to overcome some of your own prejudices to make Ammo work for you? Absolutely. But rather than being another program that rah-rah shishkoom boss tries to get you emotionally excited only to offer unclear methods, Ammo shows you how to design profitable ads step by step through a unique, highly tested and targeted formula. The founder, Steve Piper, is a data-loving, formula-driven author who escaped the kingdom of Amazon to build a platform for himself, where he sold directly to his readers and built a loyal following and millions of copies sold. With Ammo, you know who's reading your books, how to contact them, and what they want to read next. If you've always been frustrated with Amazon's wall of mystery of not knowing who's reading your books and losing 50 to 70% of your hard-earned money that you are making through sales, Ammo solves all of those problems by putting you in the driver's seat and showing you how to fulfill your books directly to your readership. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
That's kind of her too. And so that seems to be one of the characteristics of COVID, is like it does something with congestion so that it just like completely fills your head like an atomic bomb. For me, it just lasts a lot longer. But yeah, I hate COVID.
Yeah, man, your Ben Wallace episode, I was listening to the intro and I was like, oh, this Ben Wallace guy has a cool voice. He sounds very wizened, like he's lived many life lessons and has a lot to say about a lot of things. And I was like, oh, wait, that's Jody.
not very wise and has a lot of things to say about a lot of things. Okay, so let's pepper in some podcasty type things. One is that actually, truth be told, you're probably the OG of doing like book shows and stuff like that. You were going to farmers markets before I ever went to Cincinnati, before I was aware of who David and Lydia Scherer were, before I even did my episode with Michael and Robin Sullivan. You were setting up tables at farmers markets in different places to sell your books. Why did you decide to do that? And tell me, like, how many copies in the early going did you have to sell to feel like it was a good use of your time?
A lot of the places that I sold at didn't charge me, or it was like anywhere from like $30 to $50. So you know, on the fourth book, you've at least
you've broken even.
Yeah, you've made it worth your while to be there financially. And there were days when I sold, you know, three or four books, and there were days when I sold 20 plus at these different, you know, just little small pop-up type places.
Yeah.
But really, just because of my podcast, the people that I talk to on my podcast, it's not just writers, it's kind of everybody.
Right.
Which is why the numbers probably aren't as good as yours. People have said, if you want to have a good podcast as far as like reach, you got to niche down. And I didn't do that. But what it did do was help me. I met a lot of artists and people that you know, make visual art that sell at those kinds of places.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of followed this little community that I had built up to the places that they went. And yeah, so it wasn't like I originally said, you know what, I'm going to turn this whole book selling thing on its head. It was just like, I don't know where to go. Oh, you guys are going over there. I'll go over there too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seems to be the way that it happens one way or another, is that you like see what other people are doing and think, I want to copy that. And then sometimes you adapt it for what works better for you. I'm going to a thing this spring called the Strawberry Festival in basically Little Rock, Arkansas. So it's a bit of a jaunt for me. I'll be up your area as well, which is also a bit of a jaunt for me. And I think that's more in the fall, if I recall right. But I like selling in person. I really enjoy it. One thing I'm curious about, and maybe you can't even answer this exactly because you only have one book currently published, but I was wondering, like, do you notice any kind of tag on after an event where you see more Amazon sales or anything like that? Because I'll be honest, I have not ever seen any sort of boost in alternative sales following a weekend at a book fair or Comic-Con or anything like that. And it confuses me and makes me wonder.
I would see every now and then people who are like, I'm more of an ebook guy. And I would say, oh, well, sure, my ebook's on Amazon. But now I've switched to directing people to my website.
Yeah.
And I undercut the major online retailers without naming any of them by about 25%. And so, yeah, when I do sell in public, I'll see a small spike, but usually it's like within the first, you know, 1 to 3 days, and I'll go, oh, look, a couple of ebook sales must have been the people from the place that didn't want the paperback.
Yeah. I don't know what happened in,
nothing that you could even verifiably be like, oh, it must have been those people.
Yeah. In October, I had a book a day. So I sold 30 books in October, and I was like, cool, we're trending in the right direction there on Amazon. Then in November, I think I had 7. In December, I had 4. In January, I had 2.
And oh, yeah, February, dude. That's,
yeah.
It's like a...
But it hasn't recovered.
Selling books is like any good roller coaster. That first big hill is the first thing you get, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
And then it's just waves after that. You know what I mean?
As far as Amazon goes, I mean, and granted, I don't do any kind of advertising. I tried a little bit back when you were doing it. I set up some bids, and I didn't really spend much. So it wasn't like it was a negative experience, but I just didn't notice anything. Like, it would tell me that it charged me a few bucks here or there. I never, in fact, it told me, according to its metrics, that I never had a sale attributed to any of the advertising that I did. Those happened to be months where I had better sales, but I was also spending upwards of, you know, $3,000 a month on advertising on Facebook. So I would more attribute it to people's curiosity based on those Facebook ads. I've since really scaled back for a host of reasons on the Facebook ads.
Well, they will get you the clicks that they say they're going to get you, but I've noticed that they advertise a lot to people that already follow you. And I had one person comment like, hey, man, are you buying Facebook ads? Yeah. It's like, well, they're targeting your followers. Good job with that.
Oh, man. My wife and I talk about this all the time. She's like, I saw your ad again. And I really want to reach out to Facebook and be like, hey, you know, she's my wife because, like, I actually told you that. I've volunteered that information. Do you really think that she's going to buy my books? That is actually the border of ethical, in my opinion, with advertising. Is they're like, okay, we're going to get this many impressions out there, and we're going to waste a bunch on people that already own your books and don't need to be top of mind because you call them for every holiday anyways, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really strange thing, social media, because the tools are there for you to get your stuff out there. It's just a matter of knowing the best way to do it, but still at the end of the day, like, you got to pay to play. There's no, I mean, you have to pay to play anywhere, but specifically with that kind of stuff, you don't know that you're getting anything other than an impression and a click. And then once it's forced it upon enough people that it's done the bare minimum, then it's like, all right, we're done. Give us more money.
Yeah. One thing, I mean, there are a multitude of things that I like about social media. I do know that sooner or later, if you continue to persist, you will figure out something that works. It's like the curve with anything. It's just a really expensive game to learn. But the other thing that I was thinking too is,
and it comes with some emotional damage. Sorry, I just wanted to talk about the your tweet that got hundreds of thousands of views.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, definitely.
What a book should and shouldn't do, and people were like, "This guy's an idiot. This guy's a dumbass. Look at his Amazon sales rank. What is he talking about?" Like, whoa! People started getting like real personal just because you had an opinion. It wasn't racist. It wasn't political. It was just a, this is what I think a book should be. Man, fuck you.
Yeah, exactly. It was intense. Yes. Well, I guess since we're gonna touch on this, I will say there are a couple of things to that tweet that are really interesting to me. One is I said solely entertains. Anyone who writes a book that aims solely to entertain is failing their readers. Something along those lines. And I was really surprised because one person, Martine Proctor, Emmy Proctor is her author name. She got back to me from my newsletter and was like, well, I understand why people are outraged because you called them failures. And I was like, well, in response to her, I said, I didn't call anyone a failure. I said, anyone who does this is a failure. And I don't know a whole lot of people who write solely to entertain, but I wanted to put a bright spotlight. And I guess I did a good job of that on the idea that like escapism, if you read to escape and you want to be entertained and you want to forget this world, you might be dealing with a sickness of a sort. And that was how I hoped the conversation would go. But people really took that personally. And it's okay.
they did.
Yeah.
I tried to get you back for a while, but then I was like, man, this is causing me too much emotional damage.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that. I appreciated that you actually went after a few of them. And it was also funny just to see your response. Similar to the tweet about alcohol and marijuana. I really enjoyed like you jumped on that one and how many people were just positive that marijuana was more dangerous. And,
man, at least three people for a week like went back and forth with me. Some even started DMing me like, hey, listen, I'm not trying to make this personal, but like people in my family have thick blood, so we need to drink alcohol. I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's like if people in your family have thick blood, then you need to go see the doctor. You don't need to drink.
Yeah, actually, alcohol is going to thicken your blood. Cheers. Yeah, that's insane.
Some people were coming at me with some hard facts when I was like, okay, I see what you're saying, but. Yeah. But then some people were just coming at me with their backyard logic, and I was like, no.
Yeah, and this is neither a fact nor anything. I briefly experimented. When I was on carnivore, I was in a state where it was legal, so I experimented with a couple of pre-rolls. And man, oh man, like one hit and I was in another universe. I made a couple of critical mistakes. One was I was leaving the gym to try to find a place to sleep for the night. And so I just figured like, it's 3 minutes away, I'll be fine. So I took a hit in the parking lot and thought like before any effects get in, like I'll be where I'm gonna be. That was the first mistake. Don't be like me. But like literally then I realized like I'm not pushing the gas pedal because I'm so like depressed after just, and like when I say depressed, I mean my nervous system is like pressed down. Yeah. And I like forget I'm driving and I'm like, I've been at this stoplight forever. And then I get like the paranoia, like the cops are watching me right now. And I'm like,
did it turn green and I missed it and it turned red again?
Yes. I literally had those thoughts. I was like, I think I've waited through multiple signals now. And I just am absolutely freaking out. And also at the same time, the other part of me is like, calm down, buddy. Just be aware. Everything's okay. Get where you need to go. You know, you made a mistake.
That party deep down is like, it's just the drugs.
That's exactly right. Breathe. And there is something to be said for that because I've used anybody who listens to this podcast long enough knows I'm a big fan of drugs. I love all drugs. Some I get along with a lot less well. And it seems like for whatever
crack
reason,
and drugs like those.
Thankfully, I've never used crack. I've never used cocaine.
When you say you love all drugs.
That is true. Yeah, that's true. In theory, I even love those drugs. I'm just a little bit scared. So I'm a big fan of Dax Shepard. And he talks about how alcohol caused the knock-on effect of him. Like he would drink and it wasn't the alcohol that was the problem. But when he was drunk, he was like, let's go find cocaine. I had a period of
keep this in my party life, going.
Absolutely. I had a period in my life kind of similar to that where I dealt with a brief but pretty robust period of kleptomania. And I would drink and I'd be like, let's go steal some books. Like, I loved going to Barnes and Noble and just like loading up and walking out like, hey, it was just like so fun for me. And so there was a long period of sobriety. And I think that for me actually did sort of kick that part out where I learned how to deal with it and didn't necessarily associate it. So there are some huge issues with drugs. I'm not recommending that anybody use them. I'm just saying for reasons I can't understand, they're a big part of my life. And I really enjoy how they help me develop as a human. Well,
and even talking about psychedelics, we know now that psilocybin has a lot of good uses for people with PTSD, for people with anxiety about end of life that are, you know, terminal patients, things like that. Yeah. But I saw something in the news just the other day that said taking LSD one time can have immediate and lasting effects on depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
Which is wild to me. LSD scares me a little bit. I've never tried it before. I think just the idea that it's, you know, a man-made chemical thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
kind of scares me, whereas psilocybin is natural and doesn't seem to have any kind of real hangover effect other than your body kind of actually wants to distance itself from that drug for, you know, several weeks to months, which is kind of cool.
I actually, so the one caveat for LSD that I would love to use it if I knew that it was pure, I would get
it. That's the thing, you don't know where it came from, who made it. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about psilocybin too. Yeah, somebody might have grown it in their bathroom, but like
theoretically, and this honestly is like a theory, is that if I were ever going to use magic mushrooms, I would have grown them myself. So that's just theoretically. And it would be for the exact same reason that you're stating, is I wouldn't want to buy it from somebody on the street and be like, what am I getting? I don't necessarily know which mushroom this is. But if you were to buy like a syringe full of P. cubensis and learn how to grow it yourself, then you would know for sure that you were buying from a lab tested company and that you had spores that were the exact mushroom you wanted.
Yeah.
Then when you are in the mind altered state, and you're pretty sure you're dying, the one thing that you know, and this proves true, by the way, then you know, I'm not dying because I took something poisonous. I'm dying because my mind has been opened so wide that it's going to split open and just destroy my body. You know, that's why you start to think you're dying. And it's the same thing we were talking about with smoking the pot. It's kind of like, I know I'm in a drug state right now, but I absolutely know that it's not a danger to me physically, and that helps you stay grounded. So
yeah, because some people go, am I gonna have a heart attack? Like, no, dude, nobody who didn't already have severe heart problems had a heart attack because they had smoked too much.
Exactly
You might have had an anxiety attack, but they
and that's a strange thing about marijuana in general, is that it really, like, I keep saying grounds because that's the experience for me, is like it makes me feel just all around heavy, like I'm attached to the ground. But it also, so you would think that it's like calming and grounding, but it also causes a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah, well, and it can be I can't remember because I'm not educated enough. I've only heard enough that I can sound like I know things. But there are different strains with different terpenes, and certain terpenes are actually bad for people with anxiety. And they say, like, if you're a PTSD veteran, or just anybody with PTSD, I guess, stay away from certain terpenes because those can be more triggering for anxiety, whereas others can pull back. So between all the different strains and chemical compounds in those strains, then you can get one that makes you feel like, man, I want to go for a walk, or one that makes you be like, man, I'm going to go take a nap.
Yeah. I heard an interesting thing the other day about PTSD that I've been thinking about in other areas of life, but apparently, and I'll try to find the study for the show notes, but apparently people who suffer from PTSD were not the people who were involved in combat, but the people who had the potential to be involved in combat, that it is more mentally, psychologically destructive to think something bad might happen. And like that just looming sense of something bad might happen causes way more damage than the people who were seasoned in combat and went into combat a lot, because it was almost like they talk about with motion sickness is your body not being able to understand that you are in, you know, movement, versus like if you sit in the front of a car and look out, you don't get motion sickness because the two things sync. It's that same kind of principle of like Your mind feels that there is danger, but your body's like, I'm just literally sitting in a chair in a barracks right now. Nothing is dangerous. And the further out of sync you get, the more likely it is to have PTSD. I think about that because I think, and then I want to hear kind of your thoughts, because you obviously were in the military. But I've been thinking about it in terms of people who really have a hard time getting outside of their comfort zone in selling their books, specifically. It's like, I'm not going to go to a book selling show because I'm going to fail. I'm not going to make my money back, whatever it might be. And the more time you spend thinking about all the dangers of it and not actively forcing yourself to do it, the harder it becomes. You almost get this like PTSD type of syndrome where just the thought of it is going to stop you in your tracks.
So you're comparing selling books to having PTSD?
Damn straight I am. Hot take, TRBM. I'm going to tweet that out later.
That's your next big hot take, yeah. I don't know, man. I've always been a pretty high energy, look at me kind of guy. So I never had a problem with really getting out there. I think the biggest problem, looking back on it, is the first time I went to sell books at a art show, I just showed up with a table and books and no signage, anything. Yeah. And I think I might have been like, hey, does somebody have a piece of paper? And I just wrote like $15, stuck it next to the books. Brilliant. So, I get scary flashbacks of selling books, but nothing I would compare quite to the PTSD. Although I will say, talking about the Self-Published Authors Collective, I still want to help sell with that. But the idea of doing that is scary. And if you could make me an informational video.
Yeah. Yes.
That would help a lot too.
Yeah. That's a great stop along the conversation for the day is I really want to get SPAC going again. Let's see. Okay. So my friend Rich recently lost his brother. He's talked about it publicly. So
Rich Hosek?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, Rich. His twin brother.
And he has talked about it publicly, so I'm not like saying anything he hasn't said. And that derailed him for quite a while. Very obviously, he had a really profound and cool experience afterwards that was very healing for him. I recently lost my cat, which is, I understand for most people listening, they can't even be equivocated. Like there's no equivalency. But like he slept in my arms for 15 years. And
if you're not a cat or an animal person, then you don't get it.
But there, I had these touch points, these moments throughout my day, and I'm really still learning all the different ways where I no longer will. I'll probably still make jokes because I'm the kind of person who thinks if you are off limits to make a joke, you probably are doing something wrong. Like you can joke about any sacred cow. That being said, I will always understand people who talk about emotional support animals because, like yesterday or during the situation with the tweet, like that would be a moment if I ever just felt completely beat up and lonely, I would walk away from my computer, my cat would be there and I would go and I would just like cuddle him for a minute. And he offered some kind of like warmth and welcoming to me in almost every situation where I needed it. If I got animated, he would come around and try to calm me down. And I think that it's interesting. And so I'm saying all of this to say that when he passed, I completely stopped making calls. I have made almost no calls for SPAC since. And I keep telling myself, you know, like pull up your bootstraps, you pansy, like get to work. And day after day after day, I keep not doing that.
I'm 4 books into a 9 book series. And every single day lately, I find myself thinking, boy, it would be great if I had some central location for all of my notes, all of my plot points, character names, family lineages, you name it. I wish it was in one place because let's be honest, the way that I am using Microsoft Word as a word processor and have 55 different documents to keep track of all of the series details that I need to access, I'm taking more time opening up files wondering, why did I name this one that? Why did I name this one that? And not getting the information I need. Enter Scrivener. You guys know that I do not advertise for things unless A, I'm using them myself, and B, I think that you could up your game, sell more books, do better marketing, and get yourself in the game better. And that is why I am now partnered with Scrivener. If you use the link in the show notes, you get a 30-day free trial, and then you can sign up
as well for a discount. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
Which it needs to change, but man, oh man, like I was not prepared for that situation. So I can only imagine, wrapping up this whole story, how Rich might feel. And so it's really impressive because he's gone on to make some amazing podcast episodes. He's been coming to book selling events with me, and, it's just very, very difficult. Something I was not prepared to deal with that continues to have consequences. But yeah, SPAC, I think, is probably the sleeper of all the things that I'm doing that will have the most outsized impact, because every bookstore that you bring in, that you build a relationship with, has a cyclical nature. Like they're going to keep taking these books. They're going to keep building this relationship, and it gets easier and easier the bigger it gets.
And speaking of, you know, I'm trying to think of adding some useful content to your podcast, but anybody who is part of the SPAC, or does something kind of similar on their own, you can share a booth with other writers at a table, or share a booth at a table, share a table or a booth at a convention where normally they're like, no, you can't do that. Cause I remember asking one convention, I said, hey, can me and two other people sell together? And they said, only if you're there representing your publisher.
Yeah. Right.
So
that's brilliant. Actually, that's, actually, that's a really good point.
There you go. TRBM crowd. Fuck you. I told you something good.
Wow. Man.
And now you got to edit the whole thing out.
Yeah, exactly. No, I keep it all. I pretty much keep it all. One of the things I've done with the podcast, partly because I feel like it's our lane, is like I minimally edit anything. I make sure I start where the conversation is actually juicy, and I make sure I end when the conversation is actually done. But other than that, like a lot of the stuff in the middle, all I do is I go through Audacity real quick and I truncate the silences and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I do the same thing. If I have somebody who's ums and uhs a lot, I'll go through and take out like, you know, every other one or two out of every three, something like that. Just
if
depending
it's on real bad, I'll hit the first 5 minutes. And then after that, I just don't even bother. Cause I'm like, after 5 minutes, every listener's kind of settled in and they no longer notice the ums and ahs. Maybe in those first 5 minutes really make it crisp.
Yeah. I've had a couple of guests who I get upset with myself when I hear myself, but I've had a few guests that just couldn't stop themselves from dropping one verbalized pause in almost every sentence.
Yeah. The very first guest I've mentioned before, and he's a good friend of mine. He actually let me stay with him when I was doing the Cincinnati Comic Expo in Kentucky's just across the border in a little city in Kentucky. Anyways, when he was on my podcast, very first guest, he says instead of ums or us, he says fuggin. Like he'd be like fuggin, like, you know, fucking instead of and I couldn't believe it. There were so many F-bombs in my very first podcast episode. Like, how do I deal with this? This is not something that I was prepared for.
I was going to say, you were you marked explicit from the get-go? Or, I mean, was that your plan, was to be like, anybody can swear, whatever?
Yes, I always wanted it to be explicit. I apologize. I know I'm disgusting. I blew my nose for people who aren't watching. I always planned
to be explicit. I sat here and watched.
Yes, you did. You just had to deal with it. This is amazing. I always thought it would be explicit. I always thought that if my guests wanted to talk about like God and religion and hated cursing, that I would just match and mirror them for the most part. Whatever anybody wants, I mean,
I don't like to offend anybody. So if anybody out there is like, man, that's too many F-bombs, I'm sorry. I was in the Navy. I apologize.
Yeah, I figure the listening crowd is most likely going to be of the mind that they don't mind explicit language. Even my listeners of faith probably are totally fine with the use of drugs and swearing and everything. Like, this podcast doesn't back away. So
they are people too. I remember the first time I went out with some people from a church that we used to go to when we lived in Florida, and we were out somewhere. It was like all just some adult couples, relatively the same age. And one person says something like, damn, we've been waiting here a long time. And then as soon everyone just kind of looked at him like, and then we all looked at each other like, is anybody going to be like, don't talk like that? And nobody got mad. And then everyone started swearing. It's like, oh, okay.
This is great. He broke the wall, and now the dam is flowing forth.
Yep.
The dam is flowing forth.
The dam is broken. Now the shits are flowing.
That's right. So great. The cough just won't die.
I'm going to stick to music. I'm not funny.
Yeah. You actually are very funny. You're naturally funny. Your timing is good. You have really good comic timing. I think I am only funny if I have somebody good to play off of. And also, I think I'm only funny to a certain kind of person.
Yeah, my teachers didn't think I was funny. That's where I think I developed my timing, though, was like teachers were always like, you know, you're going to work at McDonald's someday. I was like, well, better than working at a high school, you know, like yeah. something like that. Just
yeah.
So, yeah, I think any of my timing that I do have probably came from self-defense from authority figures when I was a kid.
Probably every good thing that we've developed came from self-defense against authority figures, including our parents.
Bark, 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 bark. Sorry, I do that. I do that to my wife when she coughs, and she absolutely, I was going to say she loves it, but I can't even say it. She hates it. Oh my. Yeah. She's like, why?
Yeah. It's getting really bad right now. I'm drinking plenty of fluids and it's just, it's coming after me.
Yeah. I'm drinking a delicious, Miel latte that I made myself from my Marva DeLong High coffee maker.
Yes. This episode is brought to you by DeLong High. I think they pronounce it DeLonghi, which is so ridiculous. I almost said the R word, which that probably I would have had to cut. It is quite ridiculous. DeLonghi. It's DeLong High.
You can say it however you want to. Apparently, I might have said this to you the last time I was on your podcast. I only have like two stories. when J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she originally wanted the bad guy to be called Voldemort. Like with a French.
Oh sure, yeah, kind of a French.
Tea.
Yeah, I vaguely recall this. Yeah.
And then when the first audiobook came out, he said Voldemort, and she was just like, "All right,
okay, Voldemort." Yeah. Interesting. So she thinks of the French in general as being, you know, the ultimate in evil.
Yeah.
Which doesn't surprise me a little bit. I feel like the English and the French are sort of always a little at odds with each other.
Yeah. Well, I don't know my history well enough to get deep into it, European history anyway, but France seems to be kind of like the butt of a lot of jokes. Like it's kind of like the Ohio to the Midwest of.
Okay. Sorry, actually, people in Ohio. No, please. We absolutely have to talk about this because my children come home and they're always talking about Ohio. And I'm like, where did this come from? What does it mean? Why do they keep using it? I know that they're using it like an insult, but I don't even understand. That's how.
Yeah. There's so many reels and TikToks about Ohio. Yeah. Where it's like, hey, welcome to Ohio. And then they're like, they'll show you like nothing at all. And then they'll be like, you can't leave. And they'll like try to like grab you.
Yeah. Interesting. I somehow they have completely caught the Ohio thing and it's missed me entirely.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make at least two stops and then anything you want to talk about too, because technically this is the guest host episode. The first stop is going back briefly to the discussion of drugs. Both you and I have recently experienced either periods of sobriety or like a change in the way that we interact with substances. And I think that there's been some positives. So for the substantive amount of time that I was on carnivore, I was using no alcohol whatsoever at all. And I noticed pretty quickly that there were a lot of positives. I don't remember all the circumstances, and I apologize, but you took a brief break from marijuana and noticed some productivity, a little bit of weight loss, things like that. Where are you at with it right now? What are your thoughts on like substance, creativity, productivity, all that kind of stuff?
Well, I'll start by saying that I am pro cannabis, but having the experience from using cannabis like pretty much daily and then stopping for about 2 weeks. I went into something that I guess you might call like a withdrawal, but it wasn't really like withdrawals in the classic sense. It was more just a very heightened anxiety. Like I felt it in my stomach. So I was taking CBD and I was, taking chamomile in the mornings and the evenings, and that helped a lot. Just because of the way that cannabis suppresses your, I don't know if it's actually stops you from making stress hormones or if it stops you from absorbing them, but it actually disrupts the process of like feeling stressed. Yeah. So when you disrupt that natural process long enough, then the bounce back can be pretty intense for the first few days. And I didn't eat a lot and I didn't sleep well, but once that went away, then I started just felt like my brain was on fire. It was like, I just want to do all these things and So I went into a crazy wave of production and getting things done.
Yeah.
And then have since like started easing cannabis back into my diet.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I don't, you know, wake up and go take a hit to kind of start my day. I make sure I get everything done first. And then that's kind of like my treat at the end of the day.
Sure. Yeah. That's I mean, that's how alcohol, like probably the times in my life when alcohol was there definitely was like, I noticed a process with me where it would get earlier and earlier and earlier.
Yeah.
And there was a point where my wife was like, it's not really appropriate to start drinking like right now. And I was like, according to who? Have you ever heard of Wake and Bake? Like, what's the difference?
Yeah. Oh, society and their rules.
Exactly. I actually do believe that more or less. I believe that if you are able to function by whatever means necessary, then function. If you endanger other people, you're probably getting into some gray areas, but that would actually go so far. And this is where I'm going to get myself in a whole lot of trouble. I actually don't have an issue with somebody driving if they've had drinks, if they are what's the word I'm looking for here? If you've built a tolerance, because like there is, I would love to see research that proves this wrong, but there is absolute ability that's gained with tolerance. And it goes back to that early part. Like I'm guessing, and you can plead the fifth or not comment at all, whatever you want to do. I'm guessing that you are completely capable of driving under the influence of cannabis as long as you haven't like really hit it super duper hard.
I actually had a friend, shout out to Mike Logan, the ice cold comedian. He said one time, when we were trying to get somewhere and we had taken a couple hits before going to a restaurant or something like that. He goes, man, you would be terrible at what do they call that? That like motocross car thing where those the guy in the one seat with the map who's like, turn left in 300 meters.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Like those guys.
Yeah.
He's like, actually, no, you would be great at that, but you would need to have that guy in the seat being like, here, you need to turn here now, get in the right lane.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think my driving skills would be okay, but I might end up like doing 18 loops around the roundabout before I'm like, wait a minute, which way was I going?
Yeah, so I guess it affects us all pretty similarly in that case. Because I'm like, it's a feature of living in a small town. But I have, and I'm actually, this is not one of those cases where I'm saying I have a friend, because this town is so small, I literally don't drive here. If we go to the bar, I just walk. If I go to the gas station to get more alcohol, I just walk. Like. And so that has actually enabled my drinking behavior to get really bad, because I can walk anywhere I want and not worry about driving. Being said, there are people who drive down to the golf club 17 sheets to the wind. People drive so drunk in this town because it's a small town and they think it's just going five blocks. There's only one cop. What's the chances type of stuff?
Yeah.
With that said, like I have had
people get soberly, smashed on the golf course.
Yes, people get smashed on the golf course and then they drive home. And I've seen so many people, I've had so many conversations with, but hypothetically, like my brother-in-law, and not even known he's been under the influence. And that man can like put away the Bush Light. So I think tolerance does affect how we behave and what we're capable of doing. I'd love to see a research study on it, though.
But it's hard to govern on individuality.
I know, absolutely. And I'm not suggesting that we change the laws. I'm just saying like there is
0.08 might be sloppy for some people, and
yes,
point
sharp as a tack,
and 0.12 might be nothing to somebody else.
That's completely right. And so that I guess that's all I'm, the only real point I'm making is I'm a nonconformist. And so I don't actually particularly mind, say that's somebody whose kid has gotten run over by a drunk driver. And that's why this tweet all of a sudden is going viral again. I'm just trying to tank my career. Okay. So we've talked about the use of, not completely.
He's using social media for disruption.
Exactly. I love to read while I've had a moderate number of drinks, but I truly won't even attempt to write anymore if I've had a moderate number of drinks, because I always think it's the best stuff in the world when I'm writing it and I'm a little bit on drunkish.
I was going to say, doesn't everything seem like it's awesome when you're drunk, though?
Yes, exactly. And then you come back around and you're like, God, I can't believe I said that.
Dude, the Volkswagen Rabbit was an awesome car. I don't know what you were talking about. The next day you're like, the Volkswagen Rabbit, what the hell? Thing had like 1.5 horsepower.
Yeah. Do you are you like the Hunter S. Thompson type who's like write sober, edit drunk? I think for or edit high. I think I remember us talking about this at some level. Or is it even Hunter S. Thompson? Am I
missing? I was going to say, I don't know if he was ever actually sober at any point. I can write high, but I think I just do it a lot slower. Like, honestly, I can crank out a day's worth of pages and then type them in probably 2 hours, give or take, versus it probably would have taken me 2 hours just to write that much, and then I'd still have to type it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know that it stopped me from thinking at all, but it definitely slowed me down, and I would maybe like be like, and like think about an idea for a lot longer before I'd start actually writing it, you know, just kind of like get thinking about something and kind of get stuck in a little loop of thought where you can't really get out of it anymore.
Yeah. I'm really curious why cannabis seems to do that. That seems to be the feature of what it's doing, is creating loops. It causes you to like circle back on a thought and you're like, wait, I just thought about this.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying anything new here. I think Joe Rogan has said this a bunch too. One nice thing is it makes you think about things that you normally would try not to think about.
Yeah.
And it kind of forces you to it keeps putting it back in your face. Like, no. Think about the way that you yelled at your kid. Like, how would they, how did they interpret that? Don't rub it off. It's just, they'll be fine. You know what I mean? Like little things like that,
which
I think are great at times, but if you're doing it all the time, then you just kind of become like a little bit burnt out, you know?
Yeah. That's that is the perfect cap to this part of the conversation, because that is why I'm so fond of drugs. I have some of the best outcomes have been when I had one of those drunken, this is a brilliant idea moments. I'm not going to name them because I think in some ways it would diminish what the accomplishment was, or make people wonder like, oh, really? But I have scored guests for this podcast that are bigger than the normal guests because I lost my inhibitions while under the influence of alcohol and just wrote off a quick moment of inspiration email. And like, I've done a lot of things like that. I've made good money because I was drunk and uninhibited. So that's why I'm a big fan. There's big consequences when you make the wrong choice. And so that's the danger of it. But I love it.
You get really drunk and then they remember that person that toilet papered your house in high school and be like, you ain't shit, man.
Exactly. Yep. Oh man.
Sending people weird messages on Facebook.
Exactly. Yes. Sending weepy emails or text messages to long lost friends.
Yeah.
Never a good idea. So my next question for you, I know that you are still in process of putting together your second book. One, how's it going? But two, how do you plan to use it? I mean, are you going to immediately fold it into your book shows? Like what's your game plan, I suppose?
Well, going off of some of the things I've heard from your podcast, once I have more than one book, I'll probably be bundling them, you know. I might say something to somebody like, hey, they're 15 a piece or 2 for $40. And then they're like, what? I'll be like, I'm just kidding. two for 25. Like, huh? Well, okay.
Dad, I would love to see that deal work though. Cause I mean, like what happens when a person just gets pulled in? You're like, yeah, it's 1 for 15 or 2 for $40. And they're kind of,
you can make them stop walking. That's already like 50% of it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I love that. I might try that at this Sunday show. See what happens. I might even sell a deal that way, like 1 for 15 or 2 for $40. That's my best deal. 2 for $40.
Yeah, but you get both of them.
Exactly. You can't buy them individually. You can either buy one or you can buy two. Those are your choices.
I mean, like, that doesn't make any sense. Just give them like but this one goes to 11. Just like, you have no idea what they're trying to tell you.
Oh, yes. Elon Musk. Put the volume goes to 11 because of Spinal Tap. Is that right?
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. He's got the volume that goes to 11, and then they've got, instead of calling it sport mode, they call it ludicrous mode after Spaceballs.
I love that. I like his playfulness a lot. I don't know how I feel about him in entirety. I like X. I like how it has shaped out. There are so many like scammers on X compared to everywhere else. But
do you think so?
It's been my experience, yeah.
Man, I don't know. There's a whole lot of girls that want you to look at their websites. I'll see that a lot of times in my stories. I'll look through, see who looks at my stories on Instagram, and then now they've got a spam option, which is awesome. Thanks, Instagram, for that. And now it'll separate. Somebody called them fembots. I think maybe it was Heather O'Brien that calls them fembots.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah. Shout out to Heather. Heather's pretty cool. I've gotten to know her on social media.
Yeah.
Social media is not all bad.
That's right. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. And actually, when I quit using weed for a while there, I made a bunch of sales in 1 week on Twitter. Which
yeah,
was
that's
weird.
Right. Talk about that a little bit. Was that just like luck? Was that the universe trying to tell you, like, you're on the right path? Or was it something
Yeah, no, I think it was just because I was just more present in general, and that crossed over into, you know, these otherwise very kind of, not farcical, but, you know, very like shallow, I guess, relationships that you build with people that you only know online and from that app. You know what I mean?
Yep. So it's just the deepening of relationships. Then people are like, I'm going to take a try. Okay. So talk about your second book. I mean, it's where are we at in the process? Is it near? Is it imminent?
I originally wanted to have a June release, and hopefully I still can, but my absolute deadline for having it ready is when you and me are selling books at the Capital. Capital City Comic Con. Is it July 12th, 14th? It's like right in the middle, second weekend in July.
After the 4th of July. So yeah.
Which is exciting for me. I've actually been talking about it with people. I'm like, I'm going to go sell books at like at one of the big boy book shows for real now.
Yes. Yeah.
First time.
Yeah. It's going to be fun, man.
Rich, right?
You know what? That's a good question. Rich may be there. He may not. Let's see. I'm trying to think. So there is the Chicago Printers Row thing. I'm trying to remember when that's going on. He may not want to double up, and wouldn't be double up because they're different weeks, but they're close, I believe.
Yeah.
So he may not come to that one. He also is spreading his wings, and I think that he may not actually verbalize this, but I think he might believe, similar to me, that your very best sales will always come alone. If you can swing it to do a book event all by yourself, you'll make, it's like an exponential growth. I don't know why this happens. You would assume it was the other way around, but if you go alone, you will sell more than double what you will sell if you go with another person. And I think what happens, this is my theory, is that when someone comes to a table with two authors, the presentation of choices will sometimes prevent them from going into like the spiral of purchasing behavior. That sounds really technical, but I think that that's the case. So sometimes you'll get someone who would be like, oh, mysteries. I like mysteries. I'll buy them. When it's like mysteries or I don't know exactly what your pitch for switchers would be, but like sci-fi of some kind. So you know, when it's mysteries or sci-fi, then they might be like, huh, I like both. Can't decide. I'll come back. And it's that I'll come back moment where they have to think about it, that then they don't come back and you don't sell. So I think he's noticed that. And Rich is like, I'm doing my first solo in Madison, Wisconsin, coming up whenever, I think it's in May or something like that. And I was like, originally, I think you invited me to that, but now you've declared you're going alone. And that's totally cool.
You know, there might be something to bark, 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 bark. There might be something to that. But it also might depend on like the vibe there, because if they get a sense of like, this guy wants me to buy his books, but this guy wants me to buy his books,
could be.
But because like when I sold with Albie, who hopefully will be on your podcast soon, Albie Blazo, aka Lisa Mason, we had a pretty good thing going where like between the two of us, but like she writes romance, I write kind of like dark sci-fi, I guess,
right?
So between the two of us, we'd be like, hey, do you like to read? And people would walk up, like, well, what do you have over here? And then be like, sci-fi and romance. And then they'd kind of be like, oh. And then, you know, whichever one they'd walk over to, the other person's like, yeah, it's really good. You know what I mean? Like just.
Oh, yeah. And I think we do that well. In fact, Rich and I'm fairly confrontational just in life. So I told him immediately, it's like, I want to sell books. And I was like, so I'm always going to want to sell the books that you sell. But in order to kind of not just trick myself, but also make me support you, let's at least offer deals when it makes sense. So I do a 1 for $15, 2 for $25, 3 for $35. So we open that up and just said any book after the first book is an additional $10. And then you just split the money among you and figure out how it works. So we sold a lot of deals where it'd be like the first in series for both of us. We sold all 6 books in the series a couple of times. So like his 3 and my 3. And that's really cool. I think we did that a lot, but I still think there is something to, there's people who might self-select out of one, but still just having the option there sort of like prevents them from going into buy mode. Now that's my speculation, because I've never had as good of a show with multiple people as I have when alone.
Yeah. Well, you've never sold with a guy that looks like this.
Damn straight. And then, again, I think what you're hearing is me saying I'm prepared to really have a shitty capital city experience. That's ridiculous. It's going to be so much fun. We're going to make a ton of money. I will make a lot of money. And I will even help you sell your books. Like, I will be like, Chris Talon is the schnizzle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But you can call me Christopher.
Oh, is that right? I have to call you Christopher professionally. I'll remember that.
Yeah.
Is that true? You actually would prefer Christopher in a professional setting?
In a professional setting, I guess. Yeah. But just talking to you, I don't care.
Yeah. I suppose that would bother me if somebody was like, yeah, check out Jode's books. You're like, it's Jode D. Thank you very much.
No, I said Chode.
Chode. Chody Sperming. That was my nickname in school. Chody Sperming.
Yeah.
Guys, it was tough.
Yeah, that's not a great one, but I've had some bad ones too with my real last name.
Oh, that's right. We've touched on this before. I do not recall what your authentic last name is.
I'll just say it, and I'll see if anybody out there can spell it. I will send you a free book. My last name is Calcagno.
That's right, Calcagno.
It's Sicilian.
You're Sicilian. Are you 100% half. Sicilian? Like, oh, no. Half. Okay.
My dad's parents are both from Italy, and my mom's parents are of German descent, but they're like, you know, third or fourth generation. They were already third or fourth generation, so the German heritage is all but gone, you know what I mean? There's not like flags and pictures of the old country, and nobody like says, here's some strudel, you know, like.
Oh, I hear that on the norm over here, like, have some strudel.
It is the Midwest.
It is.
Which I honestly didn't know Nebraska was the Midwest until.
Oh, really?
I think when they joined the Big Ten, I was like, they're not even in the Midwest. People are like, that's the Midwest, stupid. Like, yeah. I thought ended at Iowa.
You know what? There actually was a bit of a heated debate for a while. I remember it going on because I would tell people I was from the Midwest, and they'd be like, Nebraska's not the Midwest. And I was like, what else the F is it? It's certainly not the West. Because when you think of the West, you think of like arid deserts, mountains, you know, pine trees, all that kind of stuff. And
unless it's the NHL, then it's deep in the West.
Deep in the West, yeah. That's right. So yeah, I mean it's Midwest. It's Midwest. When you get out to the western side of the state, it does start to feel a little less Midwest.
Yeah.
Like what's Ogallala? Like Ogallala starts to feel a little bit like the West. Because there's Wyoming to think about too. Wyoming is half of Wyoming is strangely flat and barren, and that's part of the West too, but that's kind of deserty. So anyways, this benefits no one. I'm literally saying something that benefits no
one. I like learning about geography.
Yeah, love it.
I actually really want to go to Moab, Utah one of these days because of all the rock formations.
You know, my wife was dating a guy named Justin who turned out to be gay. He was supposed to go meet her. She was supposed to go meet his parents in Georgia. And right before they were leaving, he broke up with her. And it was really her first serious boyfriend. So she decided she was going to take a trip. And she drove to Moab, stayed in a bed and breakfast, ate, the beans and egg with the tortilla. What's that called again? Oh, my gosh. Ranchero, something ranchero.
Huevos rancheros.
Huevos rancheros. Yep. Had huevos rancheros and almost got lost and died in Moab. She met a runner who was running around in Moab and gotten lost as well. And he was bleeding from the nipples. I didn't even know that this was a thing, but apparently if you're a runner, like it's maybe more familiar.
It's a thing. I've had to tape mine before.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Me too. But that's because I'm like, I've got perpetual diamond cutters. And so every once in a while I get a little bit nervous, stroll a little duct tape over those bad boys. Keep them down.
Your camera ready at all times.
Yeah. It's so crazy.
Bark, 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 bark.
Laughing is bad for the cough. But they did find their way out. She sent a picture during that time to like our group. We were in Bible study. I was our fabled leader. And she sent out a group text, but this was before smartphones really. So it didn't tell you that it was a group text. It just, you received a text message from. So I literally thought she sent a selfie of herself in Moab to me and was like, I'm having a great time. And I was like, she likes me. We were not dating. We were not together. I had just gotten out of my own breakup. And I was like, she likes me. And so I really like went into full mode. And that's ended up being how we got married, because I made a huge mistake in her interest.
Usually people get married and then they say, I've made a huge mistake.
Right, exactly.
I made him bark again.
Yeah. Well, good grief. What do you got for us? I am out of topics.
I don't know. Oh, you know what? I never actually fully even answered your question. Did I? No, I did. The book that I'm working on now, hopefully it'll be out by beginning to mid summer.
Yes.
And it's a paranormal book, less sci-fi. It's more about a girl with supernatural abilities who tries to rescue a family member of hers from a cult and ends up getting kind of kidnapped by the cult. And has to use some of her powers to infiltrate the cult and find out what they're doing, but then also to escape it.
Wow.
So
it partly reminds me of The Running Grave by Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
If you've read that book, great book. Paranormal is fun. Cults are really fun. For this brief moment, I was actually thinking, how fun would it be to tell the story of what is a cult, but it's actually the truth? Like, you think it's a cult, but it's actually real. And so, yeah, that would be kind of cool too. Like,
yeah. And just all the things that I've learned about cults makes me see that in my research for this, I've done way more research on cults and cult leaders and cult followers than will ever actually make it into the book. But it's actually shown me though, like how pervasive cult tactics are in just our everyday life.
Oh my gosh.
Like, yeah, the military, I joined the military, you know, nobody coerced me into doing it, but everything that I read about how cult leaders like alienate and isolate and break down and build, it's like exactly what they do in boot camp.
Yeah, totally. Yes. The boot camp is like the cult indoctrination.
Yeah. And you see some people come out of that thing. They're like, oh, I actually had one guy was telling me, he was like, I don't think I can leave boot camp. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I've got it all figured out here, man. I know how it works. Like, I don't want to leave. I'm like,
yeah,
that's weird. You should want to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. He's primed for a cult. If there's any cults out there, ask Chris, he'll give you the guy's name and you can recruit a cult member.
Yeah. And don't feel bad if you end up joining a cult either. Cause one thing I found was that the average cult follower is actually of above average intelligence and they're just desperately trying to fill a hole in their, you know, void in their emotional space.
So I've been listening to this podcast, No Stupid Questions. It's a great podcast, good name. And they talk a little bit about this, that even when it comes to like the hyper politicized among us, they're almost always higher on the IQ scale than average, and quite a bit higher actually. The more like militarized you are with your political viewpoints, the smarter you are, because you start to have this belief that because you're smarter and you know you're smarter, you're less likely to be wrong, and therefore you believe the things you believe with more vigor, which is a bummer. It's almost like when you join a sales company and they're like, yeah, commissions are uncapped. But then what you realize is it literally is impossible to handle all of your accounts and make more money. And therefore it's capped by your own ability to do shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that had me thinking of something else and then I lost it too. It was really good.
Dang it. All right. So we've talked about cults. We've talked about drugs. We talked briefly about book marketing.
And we talked about something that I was going to talk about that was really interesting, but I didn't remember what it was.
Which still is really interesting, but unfortunately, you have to be a paid subscriber to get that part of the conversation. Yes. So that's what I've got. I literally, I'm coming to the point where my sick brain is starting to take over, and I'm like, I don't even know how to end the podcast right now. I'm completely out of ideas to land this ship.
Big gulps, huh?
Big gulps. Right.
Well,
exactly.
See you later.
Thank you for listening to TRBM. The theme music was provided by the ever-talented Christopher Talon. And hey, if you liked what you heard, share this show with other readers, because what's the point of telling stories if nobody's listening?